Hello, and welcome to episode 9 of Sounding Board. With festival season now almost, but not quite over, we can look forward to gigs reverting to a more urban environment over the autumn. I'm Rob Langham, and you can find us at soundingboard.podbean.com, on iTunes, at Twitter at soundingboard69, as well as soundingboard@gmx.com if you want to email us. But before a discussion that will swing back a quarter of a century to the release of Nirvana's Nevermind and will review Angel Olsen's new LP, Your Woman, we're delighted to welcome a new guest, Mr. David Cox. David, you're a keen student of Nirvana. Which artists have been your other faves down the years? What's your musical background, would you say?
Well, I love David Bowie and I love Elvis. And we went recently, so me and Ben went recently to see Elvana, the world's leading Nirvana tribute band, fronted by an Elvis impersonator. And then they did The Man Who Sold the World, I Thought I'd Died and Gone to Heaven. So it's a trifecta of my musical taste. I suppose otherwise, Pavement, The Beatles, anything really that led to or has come out of Nirvana.
Right, okay, and that gives you a little bit of a hint about how passionate the discussion is likely to be as the evening transpires. And hello to Ben as well. Ben Walker
hello.
Is here for the ninth time, I think.
Ninth, yeah.
So ever-present so far. Sadly, Neil Kennedy can't be here tonight, but we did all watch him. Well, actually, Ben wasn't there,
but David
and I saw him and his band, The Beckoning Fair Ones, produce a barnstorming set last night at the library in Oxford. And if you haven't heard any of their music, we'll put some links up on Twitter for you to be directed in that direction.
Although you'll need a tape deck.
Yes, that's true. In fact, Neil recommended last night that you could go onto eBay and hire one, and then as soon as you listen to the tape, put it on eBay to sell it yet again. Right, okay. So any music news this week, fellas? Ben, first of all.
I've got three quick things. Possibly the most significant release. We're doing Angel Olsen's album this episode, but actually probably the most significant release since the last episode was recorded is the Nick Cave album. So it's Skeleton Tree, which is out on the 9th of September, with a film showing the recording process, One More Time With Feeling, that was screened nationwide the night before. It's the 16th album of what I think David would disagree, but I would say is an illustrious career. It's also the first since the tragic death of his son Arthur. So unsurprisingly, it's a very difficult listen in terms of the subject matter. The death is addressed in the very first song, Jesus Alone, but also the experimental nature of the music. I've read some of it kind of puts critics in a bit of a difficult position, because if you criticise the album, it might seem as though you're passing a negative comment on the way he's chosen to express his grief. But I think, fortunately, it is actually a very powerful album, and it's hard to fault, I would say. A second bit of news, Fabric Nightclub has been closed down after it lost its licence. That was revoked after two drug-related deaths in the space of a month. I think there's a general feeling in the sort of music community that it's been unfairly targeted as a nightclub, made a bit of a public scapegoat, really. It just goes to prove that it's not just gig venues that appear to be under threat these days. Luke Turner's written an article for The Quietus suggesting that it's evidence of a new puritanism. I think that's possibly overstating the case, but it's nevertheless food for thought.
Did either of you two ever go to Fabric?
I've never set foot there, unfortunately not.
No, mad.
Work near there, but yeah.
Good, it's such a shame. It's a shame it's
well,
closing.
Well, yeah, because I got into kind of that scene at a good time, like late 90s.
Yeah.
Where Cream, the Ministry of Sound, was still not like a super brand. It was just a club that you went to out in London, and Fabric, God's Kitchen, like all of those places full of those superstar DJs before they became absurd. Fabric was a fantastic place, and I am sad to see its demise.
Mm. I did enjoy the music, but I was a bit of an armchair techno man, really. I saw a few gigs, saw your Left Fields and your Orbitals and those kind of people. But my clubbing days really date back to when I was at university, so before that. But yeah, so yeah.
On a more positive note, finally, I was going to mention the fact that Arab Strap, who I was championing in episode 2 way back, the Glasgow focused episode, they've actually reformed, or they are reforming, for a trio of dates in London, Manchester, and of course Glasgow in October. They've said it's a celebration of their back catalogue. It'll be 10 years since they split up. They've released a new remix of First Big Weekend, but they've actually not got any plans for any new material thus far.
Right. So. And one sentence comment on Nick Cave from you, David?
I mean, the man's just lost his son. So he doesn't need to hear from me. But I can't think of a more overrated artist apart from Morrissey.
Right, I think we've possibly chosen the wrong topic for the podcast. Would have been a lot spicier, but I have to say, I mean, just to enlarge on this, I've listened to the album once, and I would agree with the word illustrious as applied to his career, but I am disappointed with the album.
Okay, yeah.
So maybe we can touch on this a little bit more next month.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
So we shall see. And David, any news from you?
Only one, so to represent the devastatingly handsome Neil again, he turned me on to Telemann, and they're coming to Oxford to the O2 in a couple of weeks' time, and he sent me a bunch of links and stuff. I get all of my new music, really, from Neil, and I think they sound great. I can't really pin them down yet, like kind of English Riviera metronomy springs to mind, but I just think their music is great. I mean, they're hipsters, which I don't like, but their music is great, and I think they're going to put on a good show.
I think they're terrific, and we've eulogised them, I think, a few times this year on the pod. I think all of us agree it's a great album, the current album.
I still haven't heard it. Who did we see them supporting? Was that Tame Impala?
Tame Impala, I think. Yeah. 3 or 4 years, well, probably only 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
But yeah, great band. I'm actually going to see them in London, having, in a slightly numbskullish decision, opted for the gig that's 10 times the distance from where I live. In fact, actually like 100 times the distance from where I live. Anyway, my little shout, it's not so much news, but just a little shout out to the website Toppermost. And this is a site that gets contributors to list their favourite tracks from a generally prolific band or artist. So while overcoming your disappointment that Zig Zig Sputnik and Gay Dad are not represented, you can enjoy posts centering on the likes of REM, The House of Love, The Dubliners and Buddy Holly, amongst others, and really, really fine gentlemen they are too. Really, really interesting set of posts. Really recommend that. So look out for them on Twitter as well, and then that'll direct you to the site. Okay, right. The big meat of the discussion for this episode is something that we've devoted a certain amount of time to. It's probably going to be a slightly longer discussion than normal because we think it's just such an interesting topic and so many things that are apt for our deliberations. And that is, it's now 25 years since 1991 and the release of Nevermind, which was Nirvana's second album. I think that's right, isn't it? And we're going to have a big discussion about it now. David, as I mentioned in the prequel, has said that you've followed Nirvana for a long, long time, haven't you? And I first of all wanted to kick off the discussion by going to David. I mean, where did Nevermind the album come from? You know, sort of, you know, just sort of musically, socially and economically.
It's a big question. I mean, Ben turned me on to Azarad's Our Band Could Be Your Life, which is sort of the American indie underground scene, 81 to 91. So everything leading up to, well, everything leading from Black Flag up to the release of Nevermind. And it posits a number of interesting theories, as well as the theories that are propounded by other commentators on Nevermind in particular and America in general. It's basically Generation X. The first generation of Americans, certainly post-war, who knew they would be less successful than their parents' generation. And there's only so many ways you can respond to that, and one of them was a sort of exaggerated shrug of the shoulders. That's why Nevermind is a great title for that album, because it expresses a certain kind of enjoyment in slackerism, low to no fi, as manifested with the cultural emanations of Generation X are this sort of exaggerated shrug.
Yeah.
I mean, the early Black Flag is like, fuck Reagan and all of that.
And Minor Threat and things.
And it was reasonably puerile, just people barking to the converted in these kind of slam dance, kind of mosh pits. I mean, Kurt was certainly said himself, I'm no spokesperson for Generation, but what he did sort of, he encompassed in his lyrics that sort of, I mean, I think of Smells Like Teen Spirit, it's fun to lose and to pretend. I think that's a great summation of that generation. So I suppose Nirvana themselves come from a kind of soup of local and national influences. I think of Husker Du, Flip Your Wig is a big thing. He had the K Records shield on his arm tattooed famously, so kind of beat happening stuff. Because of course he's a kind of melange of influences, pop and rock. I mean, he loved the Melvins, obviously he roadied for them when he was a kid. It's a whole bunch of things. But basically I think it's kind of a response to Reagan's America. And instead of why try harder when I can kind of drop out?
Yeah, I mean, that observation you've just made about it being the first generation that's less successful than their parents is really, really interesting, because I was levelling the accusation at my dad at the weekend that they were the lucky generation. They were the people, I mean, we haven't been too badly off, to be fair, but, you know, who really, you know, have like lived a fulsome life without too much involvement from like wars on the doorstep and other sort of problems. I mean, Ben, did you think it was a case of right band, right time? I mean, is that being a bit unfair?
No, I think it's a combination of factors again, like David said, but I think that is definitely the case. But I mean, at the time I think I was 13 when the album came out, and I wasn't really reading the music press at the time. So to me, it seemed to come from nowhere, the album. But actually, in a sort of complete vacuum. But now, particularly reading that book, Our Band Could Be Your Life, and reading more around it, it's clear that definitely wasn't the case. And I mean, musically, never mind the fact of being in gestation since the early 80s, they were the band that actually took it mainstream, I think, took that sound mainstream. It's the moment that a very sort of fertile scene suddenly broke through, I think. Something has clearly been brewing for a while in that part of the country as well, I think, because as long back as, well, it's sort of 88, 89, the owners of Sub Pop had invited some British journalists over to see what was going on, and they came back and were writing very enthusiastically about the scene in Seattle, in the British press. So that's partly why I think grunge was particularly caught on in the UK, I think. This sort of seed has been sown by the likes of Everett True. So there was actually more interest here than there was there. But in terms of like, one thing you didn't mention is where it came from, just literally where it came from geographically, I think it's quite interesting. It wasn't New York, it wasn't Los Angeles, it wasn't even Seattle, because Kurt was from Aberdeen in Washington State, and he was actually quite anxious, I think, about seeming like some kind of hick or redneck to these cultured arty crowds in Seattle and Olympia. So he was always already an outsider even there. But what it did prove is that these sort of what were conventionally thought of as backwaters could actually be quite fertile, and that these sort of scenes can develop on their own in isolation. And I think in terms of the geographical location of the bands, well, I think it was important that they were that was significant in terms of the lyrical content of the angst, as well as elements of isolation and boredom, and it being a bit of a sort of cultural wasteland as well. Yes, there's a whole load of factors going on there, but they certainly they were the band that actually capitalised on it, I think, and it needed to be Nevermind. It wouldn't have been Bleach, for instance. I think Nevermind is the album that was definitely the one that was going to break them through.
Right, I'm going to compare to the other releases in a bit. But first of all, just on a sort of pure musical level, favourite song or moment on Nevermind, and what does it mean to you personally? I'll start with David.
It's difficult. I mean, because I'd like to kind of establish my lack of credentials here, right? You two have like a music journalist, you write for Night Shift. Neil, if he was here, is actually not only in a band, but is incredibly knowledgeable and passionate about music. I don't know nothing. What I do know is that I was 12 years old when Nevermind was released, and it sort of managed to cross over into the mainstream reasonably quickly, maybe in a couple of months, maybe a bit more, because of the heavy rotation of Smells Like Teen Spirit. And my strong memory, and it is absolutely like a Madeline moment for me, is sitting there as a kid in front of Alive and Kicking, which was like BBC One's kind of early morning kids TV show. Right. They had a bunch of inflatable electric guitars and they were moshing around to Smells Like Teen Spirit. And like, if you'd had a kind of MRI scan of my brain, it would have gone from grey to all the colours of the rainbow. I was like, what the fuck is that? I couldn't believe it. I grew up in a house with no books, no music, no discussions, really. I had an older sister, and she was into George Michael quite rightly, and the most mainstream of mainstream kind of 80s pop, right? British and American pop, Michael Jackson, etc. I myself wasn't that interested in any of that. I maybe read some Roald Dahl, quite like The Witches or whatever. This thing completely changed my life. I basically staggered into school on the Monday morning and I was just looking for similarly staggering kids because, like, if the arse end of nowhere had an arse end, that's where I lived, right? I was in south rural Northamptonshire. Like, to your point, I wasn't reading Sounds or the NME. I'd not even heard of those things. Like, I had no influences. I basically had no culture. I heard the opening four chords of Smells Like Teen Spirit. My entire life was changed. My friends changed. The books I read changed. The music I listened to changed. My whole intellectual landscape was utterly transformed. Like napalmed, carpet bombed. And so anyone who doesn't say Smells Like Teen Spirit off that album is being contrite and contrary. Although I would say that Drain You is a great song.
I'm going to second you. I mean, it certainly smells like Teen Spirit for me, although I came to Nirvana so late that I might have had that riff on Credit to the Nations, Call It What You Want, before I heard the Nirvana version. So I just to cut a long story short, came out of university in 1990, for whatever reasons best known to myself, didn't really listen to any new music for 2 years, just carried on listening to the Smiths and the Pixies. 2 years later, suddenly started picking up the NME again, and in the meantime, Nirvana, Nevermind, had been released, and so I got into it a bit late. So I probably got into it 2 or 3 years after it was released. But certainly for me, I think really it's such a transformational song. It's an absolute, it's a surefire bet song in the all-time top 10 songs in popular music, I would say. You know, I know that's quite a claim, but...
On yeah. that note, I was listening to Steve Lamacq, who did something on the 25th anniversary of Nevermind.
And copyist.
he was talking to another journalist about the kind of the seedbed in Britain. And to your point, we were basically suffering from a Smiths hangover. And there was something about the Sub Pop guys when they came over and the hedonism of it. Because I don't think we'd seen things like slam dancing and stuff. But I think that Americans, certainly in that scene, that because you kind of get that kind of Oregon Trail without the dysentery kind of feel from writing about Black Flag. You know, they basically punched a kind of indie railroad through the American continent, right? That the other bands, to a larger or lesser extent, followed. They all got in the van and they went. But I don't think Britain had seen that. And when they saw Nirvana, certainly in kind of 89-90, because in 90 they had most of Nevermind already in their set, they were just totally blown away by the energy of it, considering that the Smiths were over by then, and also it was all quite fey and a little bit slacker, a little bit stoner. Like, this thing was just, it was quite violent, quite confrontational, also kind of really mixed the stage with the audience, because everyone was stage diving, everyone was just going crazy, everyone was participating, and the band was still, even in those days, even though they were broke, routinely smashing up their equipment.
Yeah,
which hadn't been seen since what, The Who.
Yeah, how about you, Ben, in terms of your favourite?
Well, I was going to say I thought I might have to be defending Smells Like Teen Spirit from you two, but actually, no, that exactly the same for me, David. It was you know. Seems like a bit crass to say that I absolutely love that, but that's what lit the blue touch paper for me. I think I'll kind of come on to that a bit more later. But I mean, Lithium is an absolutely fantastic song. That is a song where I think they said, didn't they? They thought that was going to be the big breakthrough song, and then Smells Like Teen Spirit was written. Territorial Pissings is also an absolute favourite. But for me, I'm not so much a song, but the way the drums collapse at the end of Stay Away is possibly my favourite moment in any song ever, I would say. I cannot get enough of that. So there you go.
Right, excellent. So having said all this, the next question is slightly kind of moot. Because even if I had thought this was the case, i.e. whether Nevermind was overrated before this, having just listened to David speak, I don't think I could possibly say that now. Any hint at all that's overrated, maybe, well, compared to other, what came before it, other stuff Nirvana did, anything like that?
I would say, is the album overrated as a collection of songs? And I would say, yes, it is. Because, if you're talking specifically about the album, because how could an album, you know, be seen as quite so iconic and era-defining not be a little bit overrated. You know, I'm not saying it's not an extremely good album with really good production and mixing to give it the best impact. It's got, you know, loads of great songs. If we're talking about its impact and its significance culturally, then I don't think it is overrated, and I don't think it possibly could be. In fact, it's probably underrated, if anything. Personally, that's what I'd say. I mean, I've had a sort of very similar situation to David in that it was a complete year zero for me. I heard it around a friend's house. We were usually listening to Motley Crue and Iron Maiden. This came on. I thought, this is amazing. It's something completely different. I was fascinated by it. It was probably the first time I listened to something and loved it instantly. I didn't quite know why, but I absolutely loved it. It connected straight away. And I literally put my entire record collection in the bin and started from scratch. Sounds like a cliche, but then through that I discovered, it was a gateway to discovering all these other bands. I mean, first of all, Sonic Youth, but then Dinosaur Jr., Smashing Pumpkins, Mudhoney, and it all sort of spiraled from there. And the same for me, it went from music was something I took a passing interest in to that point, and then suddenly, from that point, it was an absolute obsession. It was a real, you know, life-changing experience. So personally, its impact, I don't think, could be overrated, and I don't think its impact culturally. When we come to talk about its legacy, I think I'll be arguing that its impact couldn't be, or isn't overrated there either.
So. Yeah. It's interesting you mentioned those other bands there, a lot of whom sort of probably recorded a lot of material first before Nevermind and anything that Nirvana did, and it just shows you that for a movement or a style of music, it isn't necessarily the first people who are the best. No. You know,
it should have been Mudhoney.
Yeah,
they were a great band. Touch Me, I'm Sick was a great single. Kurt was, I think, consciously stealing off them for Negative Creep from the.
Well, I mean the Melody Maker article that Everett True wrote in '89 about the Seattle scene focused on Mudhoney, and it had a bit about Nirvana in the sidebar, just a tiny little bit. I mean, they were effectively at the time a footnote. So it really should have been Mudhoney. I'd be interested to know how Mudhoney then felt about basically being dragged into the mainstream or dragged into popularity by a band who'd been playing well below them on the bills in Seattle. But
Mark Arm wasn't a big fan of Nirvana.
Not initially. I think he got more into them, didn't he? But yeah,
the first time he saw them, he left halfway through the first song.
Yeah,
right. But it's because the Seattle scene was pretty poisonous. So if you weren't that guy's friend, you were his enemy. And so there's very, I think Sub Pop had sort of organised the scene in such a way as to be extremely hyper competitive. Back to Ben's point about Aberdeen, it's a logging town. There were just brothels and taverns. It's something that we forget about Nirvana. They were a working class band.
Yeah.
And it, you know, obviously, he had these kind of anxieties about being kind of pigeonholed, as a hick or whatever. But there aren't that many truly working class voices in music like that,
and less as time goes on. That's my impression. Yeah, yeah. I mean, where do you stand on the overrated, underrated thing, particularly the album specifically?
Yeah. Well, I don't really have any perspective on it.
But is it your favourite Nirvana album?
That's a good question.
You see, it's not mine, I don't think. Well, I don't know.
It's tough. I mean, it's choosing your favourite children, I think. I mean, I just love it, and I wouldn't be sitting in this room without it.
Yeah.
You know, like it's entirely my life is up to that point where I heard that thing. On
up to sitting morning. In this room. I mean, it's all about
it. Well, yeah, basically my whole life is building to this moment. Yeah.
Well, I was thinking the same thing. I wouldn't be doing podcasts. I wouldn't be writing about music. I wouldn't be obsessed about music if I hadn't heard Smells Like Teen Spirit or the album as a whole.
I can't tell you what it was like. It was a shock. Well, I can't say that. It was a firework going off in my mind.
So just to talk a little bit more about Nirvana's oeuvre, and I think one of the particularly interesting things harks back to a podcast we had a couple of months ago, which looked at production in music. And of course, you know, have different producers with Butch Vig doing Nevermind, and of course later In Utero was produced by Steve Albini, who I think is generally seen as probably more of a kind of legend in producer terms. And then of course you've got the Unplugged as well, you know. So like in terms of their overall sort of imprint, where does it sort of fit? And is there sometimes a hint from some people that they're perhaps slightly sold out, whatever that means, with Nevermind? I mean, is there any truth in that?
No, that's outrageous bullshit.
Yeah.
I mean, like, if you, I don't know if you guys listen to the Smart Sessions, so the demo that Butch Vig, funny enough, produced for them that got hawked around all the major labels. Mm. But the songs are just too good.
Yeah.
Mm. Like, it's the quality of the songs. It's not about the Wallace tweaking of some of the drum sounds or whatever he did when he slightly remixed the original Vig production of Nevermind. Mm. I mean, Kurt was a self-deceiving individual about all categories of his life, his relationships, his drug addiction, and his fame in particular. And so he disavowed the production of Nevermind posthumously, but he was the one at the mixing desk, like famously within Utero, said you need to raise the vocals in the mix, right? He knew what he was doing. It doesn't mean it sold out, because there was absolutely no way of them knowing that that thing, instead of selling, I don't know, 300,000, which I think was its first sales projection, ended up selling 10 million in the US alone within that decade. No one in the world would have known that. It was impossible to know. It was a combination of things, many of which are intangible and completely unknowable, that made it just go catapult completely and ridiculously off the charts. Yeah. So I think that it's just one of his many kind of after-the-fact adjustments, that the fact that he hated Smells Like Teen Spirit in particular, and he hated the production on the album in general. The production on that album is perfect. It sounds fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and there's a good interview with Butch Vig on the Nerdist podcast, which he just comes across as like a really, really well-adjusted, interesting guy, you know, so, you know, sort of well worth listening to. Ben, so in terms of the albums, you've kind of hinted maybe one of the other albums is a favourite.
Well, I think, I mean, Bleach is a good album, isn't it? But it's kind of where they came from. It's quite raw. It, as I said before, I don't think it's certainly not Nevermind. It couldn't have been the album to make the breakthrough. I think In Utero is a fascinating album. I think In Utero arguably is a more, I think it's a more interesting album. Is it a better album? I'm not entirely sure. I mean, it's a direct response to, or even against, Nevermind, with that very first line, Teenage Angst has paid off well, first line of Serve the Servants. It's what it is a sort of very public attempt to retreat back into obscurity by making a deliberately challenging album. And it's kind of doomed to failure because he just had the ability to write great songs.
Yeah.
They were always going to connect. Always going to connect with people. I mean, in terms of like the sort of selling out thing, so that was a reaction of almost like, I have sold out and I'm going to try and retreat from that position. But he was very conflicted. As you said, he had this sort of, he came into it with this, subscribing to these punk rock ethics, and he was very much a fan of the K Records scene in Olympia and Calvin Johnson things, and they were all a bit puritanical. But at the same time, he loved the Beatles and he liked pop music, and he did want his music to be heard and to make a career out of it. And they weren't the first band from that sort of scene to sign to a major label. You know, Sonic Youth had done it and actually got Geffen to sign them. But he was very sensitive to that idea of selling out. The fact that he called the live video Live Tonight sold out, disowning Smells Like Teen Spirit and complaining about the mixing and things. The issue is kind of always, do you sort of rage against the machine from within the machine or from without the machine? There's a very interesting discussion of this sort of point in the Simon Reynolds book.
Retromania?
No.
Rick It Up and Start Again.
Rick It Up and Start Again, yeah. In terms of the pop group and Gang of Four. And the pop group arguing that you should always be outside of it, raging from the outside, and keep yourself ethically pure. And yet Gang of Four said it's impossible to be ethically pure. Just get in there, sign to a major label, and take it down from the inside. Mm. And I think he felt like, you know, I think the message, as you said before, they were kind of preaching to the converted, a lot of those 80s bands. And I think he felt that the message is going to be more powerful once it goes over ground, and I think it certainly was. And I think In Utero was, you know, almost an attempt to backtrack, and it was never going to work just because the songs are that strong. But it's a more interesting album, I think, because of what it's trying to do. It's trying to do the impossible, really.
Right.
I know we're kind of off Nevermind, but what do you guys make of Steve Albini? Because as part of this journey, I've been kind of engaged a lot more with him and his background, him as an individual. Like, I knew that letter that you wrote to them, kind of inviting them down to Bakiderm, and he's kind of like canonised, kind of Ian MacKay sort of level of kind of indie god. Yeah. And what I discovered was he was a deeply unpleasant man, all that rape man crap, and I think he brought out the worst in Kurt, like the antics that they got up to in that studio. I'm not that impressed by him. I didn't like him when I got to know him better. But what about you guys?
Well, he's certainly an austere, uncompromising individual. There's an interesting interview again with him, which I think is on the Marc Maron podcast.
Yes, the one I listened to.
Yeah, and he's very dismissive of the Pixies and other things, quite outrageous. But but yes, I mean that's an interesting point. I wouldn't know. I think it'd be interesting if Neil were here to be able to sort of comment properly on that, because I think he probably knows Albini better than most of us.
I think he's a complex character. I don't think he suffers fools gladly, put it that way.
I think he's a fool, though. I think he himself is a fool.
I think he's very astute. I think he's quite abrasive. Without
any
doubt.
Any person who thinks it's funny or clever to call a band Rape Man isn't a friend of mine.
Yeah, interesting.
Also, I would say, just on that last point, when you listen to the original Albini mixes of Heart-Shaped Box and Pennyroyal Tea, they are noticeably and measurably worse than the Scott Litt mixes.
Right. In terms of influences, brings me on to some of the kind of hubbub that surrounds Nirvana. And when I'm talking about influences, I'm not talking about musical influences. I'm talking about kind of personal influences. So you mentioned Steve Albini there with some interesting comments. And of course, the other big sort of presence in Kurt's life was Courtney Love, his wife, and last week I watched the film Montage of Heck, which you recommended to me, David, with some reservations. And so just in terms of the whole story around Nirvana, of course, the very, very tragic ending, which we all know about, and Kurt committed suicide. That media and the whole role of that, I mean, did it just all become unbearable, or was it the drugs, or what?
Yeah. I don't know what you think, Ben. I mean, I think that he was on a downward spiral after that Vanity Fair interview where Courtney was accused of taking heroin while being pregnant with Frances Bean, and which resulted directly in the baby being taken away from them, basically on birth, and then thereafter they had to basically be chaperoned as parents. Now, these were two serious heroin addicts. Well, certainly substance abusers. I don't know what Courtney was on, a kind of cocktail of things at that point, Ritalin or Rehypnol.
Cough syrup, wasn't it?
God knows.
Yeah.
But that is, that animates pretty much all of In Utero, I'd say, that experience. I mean, that is pretty rough to go through. And then the other thing, I think, is just the unbearable levels of fame that some person who was pretty ill-equipped to cope with that sort of attention. No wonder. It just absolutely destroyed him. And I think he was an artist in every sense. He was a great painter. He was a collagist. He was a sculptor. He was fascinated and fascinating when it came to his art. But then probably he was pretty, funny enough, quite inarticulate. And the most articulate thing he ever did was probably scream on pitch. From a very primal place. And I think he was badly advised, because you get a bunch of hangers-on, like his best friend was a heroin addict, bought him the gun that he killed himself with. I think it was sadly inevitable. I remember very distinctly getting a call from my mate. I was watching Red Dwarf, because I had tickets to Nirvana at Brixton Academy when they were supposed to come. It was April 1994. They were supposed to come to London, but it'd been kind of postponed because of what happened in Rome with the first suicide attempt, or not, depending on who you believe. He phoned me up and said, "Kurt, have you heard Kurt Cobain's shot himself?" And I'm afraid to say I wasn't surprised. I was sad, but it was like, oh yeah, well, a bit like his mum, like, just joined that stupid club. It seemed at that point inevitable, a bit like Amy Winehouse.
Yeah.
Like, it just felt a little bit like it was coming.
Yeah, very sad. I mean, I was actually in McDonald's in Golders Green reading The Guardian. But, you know, it's probably like this. I think I've only been to McDonald's once since then.
Put you off the line.
I mean, the various representations of Nirvana and the whole story in the media, not only Montage of Heck, but Come As You Are, Our Band Could Be Your Life, you know, create this whole kind of cottage industry around the whole story, which undoubtedly is completely compelling and you know, something that still resonates in across culture, particularly for people of our kind of broad generation. I mean, Ben, what's your take on some of this?
Well, I've actually I thought for this, for the purposes of this podcast, I'd start reading, pick up a copy, which I've been into for ages, start reading Heavier Than Heaven, the Charles R. Cross biography. Now, David's less than impressed with it. It's fair to say it's a pretty unflattering biography, and it's quite sort of tabloidy and gossipy in its style. It chronicles this descent into serious drug addiction, which interestingly it coincided pretty much exactly with the release of and the escalation of the Fame, I think, because he said he came back off the tour with Sonic Youth in Europe when they played Reading 91, mm-hmm. and then basically then he became a fully fledged drug addict from that point on, and he comes across as definitely self-delusional, like you said, David, and also a big self-mythologist. I think a lot of musicians, a lot of artists are. I mean, in fairness, I think very few people come out of a biography rather than an autobiography, but have a biography unscathed in some way. Interestingly, something I saw quite a while ago is a film called Kurt Cobain About a Son. I don't know whether you've seen that, David. So there's no narrator for that. It's from 2006. There's no narrator. It's just it's Kurt Cobain talking from the interviews that he did with Michael Azerrad in late 92, early 93 for Come As You Are. Uh-huh. And it's just him talking over footage of the sort of and stills of the places that he lived and the gig venues they're playing and things. So it's slightly unnerving. It feels like a sort of guided tour of you know, Aberdeen and Seattle by a dead man. It generally comes across as quite likeable in that, I think, but definitely conflicted. And interestingly, he does sound like he's already looking for some kind of escape. I think he's talking about not wanting to record with other people other than the members of Nirvana, mm-hmm. and maybe, you know, fantasizing about the idea of being in a band that's just about to make it big, because mm-hmm. I think the happiest ever was in the band was in August 91,
yeah.
Before Nevermind, all the circus mm-hmm. blew up. I would recommend that, but I haven't read Come As You Are, and I guess a lot of that will probably be in yeah. the book.
I think Come As You Are suffers from the things that official biographies suffer from, which is hardly warts and all, whereas that fucking Charles Cross book is all warts.
Mm. Yeah.
He's
yeah.
just a junkie who happens every once in a while to climb out of his pit and make some music. And I remember, well, I can ascend my high horse on this, but there's a real telltale sign in that book that it's a real hatchet job. And it's around the Unplugged performance. Whoever you are, I defy anyone, no matter what their opinion is in Nirvana, to listen to that last song with Where Did You Sleep Last Night and not get shivers down your spine. It's one of the most electrifying live performances I've ever seen. I know I'm a bit one-eyed on this stuff, but anyway, Charles Cross, it's basically Kurt jacked up, heroin up the eyeballs, hates the band, hasn't seen him in months, just bowls up to New York, someone hands him an acoustic guitar, he tries to use it as a syringe, he's suddenly playing music, and then it works out. And it's like, there was absolutely no way that wasn't a meticulously planned concert. Mm. They rearranged all of their original music, then they had 6 cover versions, all of which were sensitively rearranged. They worked in Pat Smear perfectly, as well as the cellist. They had their mates and the meat puppets there. It was a brilliantly conceived and executed plan. But the way Charles Cross explains it, it's some sort of post-junkie miracle. And I just thought, hang on a minute, there's something wrong here.
One of the biggest flaws of the book, I think, is that he's clearly a journalist. And I haven't looked this up, but he doesn't have any feel for the music. He doesn't really... And you can tell sometimes, not only that he doesn't have the feel for it, but the book's not intended for a musically appreciative audience when he's explaining what slam dancing is and things. Mm. But the music, you know, you can't really... There's no decent description in there. There's no feel for the passion of it and what's going on. It's just someone who happens to have hit it lucky with a few songs, really. But here's what's going on behind the scenes.
Quite right. And so, like, there's a biography of Roald Dahl by Donald Sturrock. I don't know if you've read it. A storyteller. Yeah. Jesus, the man just doesn't understand Dahl's writing, to exactly your point. He's brilliant on the minutiae of his various contract negotiations, but he couldn't tell you what was good or bad about the BFG.
No.
And he's tone deaf to it, in fact, whereas someone like Claire Tomlin, when she writes about Hardy or Pepys or even Dickens, she's a literary critic almost first and a biographer second, and the two things in combination are really powerful and valuable.
So who's going to write the definitive one?
Nirvana. Some combination of me and Ben, I think.
Yeah, okay, right, you know, well, listening publishers.
I'm not dealing with publishers.
You heard it here first, yeah. Middlemen, shocking characters.
I know, profit maximising scumbags.
I mean, just a little word on the Unplugged performance. I mean, at the time I remember that generally the whole Unplugged phenomenon outside Nirvana just being slightly disdained as an overly muso led thing, and the very fact that Nirvana's performance is seen as such a classic really just really shows how they nailed it that night. That really was just quite incredible.
It showed the strength of all these songs that a lot of people are writing off as just a few chords and a lot of noise.
Can I just say one other thing then? So you asked me before, like, where did they come from? We talked to a kind of socio-economic, even political kind of seedbed. They were also in the right place at the right time in terms of just the economics of the music industry, I think. Yeah. Like, MTV was absolutely at its height.
Yeah.
They were still playing things like Music on MTV, which they don't do now, as far as I'm aware. The Smells Like Teen Spirit video was on incredibly heavy rotation. There was nothing like Napster, although it was only around the corner, but physical sales of actual albums was at its peak in the kind of the early to mid-90s. And I think they were lucky with that too.
Mm.
They published into that. I think if Nirvana came out now, they wouldn't make that money. They wouldn't have that impact. They'd just be another great band on Spotify.
Yeah, I mean, where we discussed Spotify on, I think it was the last episode, wasn't it? And yes, I mean, all the things that the internet has brought with it galloping through with its horses, which really was about 94, 95, wasn't it? It's only just after. You know, Nirvana just got in there, didn't they? In terms of the continuum of Nirvana's career, and I think it's interesting to sort of try and reason, where might they have gone had the tragedy not happened? I mean, what direction would you like them to have gone in after the In Utero and Unplugged?
The strong evidence is that he'd already broken up the band when he committed suicide.
Yeah. Mm.
He'd just quit Lollapalooza, and they'd paid them $9.2 million to perform. It was in Washington, as in the state, rather than the city.
Yeah.
And he just... And that's on record, that's legal. Mm. He'd also legally filed for divorce from Courtney. So there was a lot going on in his life at that time. But he had broken up the band by that point.
Right, so we wouldn't... I mean, Foo Fighters are a band I must admit I've paid almost no attention to since they've been around.
Don't bother.
Yeah.
First albums. First albums, definitely. After that, no.
How about you, Ben? What direction would you
I think it's really hard to say this because... I mean, I was going to say the likelihood is they would have split. But you're saying they had basically split. But I would say... Maybe it's hindsight, but it's really hard to look beyond In Utero and Unplugged and see a future because both of them seem to have a real sense of finality or closure about them. And I find it hard to see that they would have recorded another studio song after All Apologies, for instance. It seems to be a natural endpoint. And then, as you say, Where Did You Sleep Last Night? The end of the Unplugged. It feels like a natural end, a natural ending, really. I mean, You Know You're Right was recorded after that, I think, wasn't it? Yeah, now that gives a clue as to where they might have gone. It's still very angsty, but it's a little bit less abrasive than the material in Utero. Personally, I would have actually liked to have seen them, certainly with hindsight, like to have seen them get even more uncompromising than in Utero, I think. Retreated even further that way, whether they would have done. It sounds like they may have been going the opposite direction, back towards Nevermind, I guess. But the split was definitely the most likely thing, I think, wasn't it, really? So.
The dynamic within his songwriting, basically loud, quiet, loud, or as he kind of, he referred to it in early versions of a couple of his songs, verse, chorus, verse, completely relates to his own personality. He was a real conflicted person between, let's say, pop and kind of hard rock or even metal. So that's one kind of dynamic. If you look at his lyrics, Come Doused in Mud, Soaked in Bleach, or Sunburn, Freezer Burn, or in Milk It, he talks about Obituary Birthday. He loved all those direct juxtapositions in his lyrics, which completely relates to himself as a personality. He was painfully shy. He was massively extroverted. He was amazingly emotional. He was amazingly withdrawn. He was heterosexual and happily married. He wished he was gay. Like, you name the kind of juxtaposition, and Kurt not just embodied it, but often suffered from it. He was a self-loathing junkie. He wished he could get clean, but he just couldn't. He just couldn't for whatever reason. He was a loving father, and yet he abandoned his young daughter. Everywhere you look in his lyrics, but basically what I mean is he had completed and perfected the loud, quiet, loud dynamic. There was really nothing else for him to do, and I think that comes across very strongly in his suicide note. He'd done what he had come to do. He'd perfected it. There wasn't really anything particularly interesting for him to stick around for.
Yeah. And beyond Nirvana and beyond what Kurt might have achieved himself, it does sound as if, you know, you're arguing that it was pretty much what we see is what would have happened. What did Nevermind inspire overall, and the band overall? What did they inspire? Not only the kind of the other grunge bands, which I'd like you to touch upon, but also, you know, just over the long term, over the subsequent quarter century.
I'll let you answer this, because my opinion of this is the only decent thing to come out directly from Nevermind is In Utero.
Yeah. How about you, Ben?
I've got one or two suggestions. So, in terms of the bands, I mean, obviously it helped popularise bands who, in some cases, have predated Nirvana, so Mudhoney. I was and still am, to an extent, a huge Soundgarden fan, Smashing Pumpkins, some the early Stone Temple Pilots stuff, but obviously it then tailed off, and it, some would say, it culminated in the likes of Nickelback. I don't think you can find Nirvana guilty for those sins.
I think they are entirely. I think they're entirely guilty for Nickelback and Bush and Stone Temple Pilots, for crying out loud, Ben.
What, you don't like Purple? Purple's a great album.
Are you seriously asking me that question?
Okay,
Spin Doctors. Yeah.
Spin Doctors, yeah. I mean, in terms of sort of, well, we've got positives, millions of musicians were inspired to pick up instruments. It was affecting, you know, it seems a bit lame to say it was our punk rock, but those lessons have been lost, and it showed a whole generation of kids that you basically, is more important to be passionate than it was to have the finesse and the polish and all the rest of it. I think obviously the song, you know, the strength of the songs is important, but I think that had kind of been lost a bit by that point in time. On the downside, well, so another positive actually is that it resulted in a lot of more A&R interest in provincial scenes, which I think is a positive. Sometimes that manifests itself as vultures looking around for the next Nirvana. You know, Arctic Monkeys come out of Sheffield, everyone wants to go to Sheffield and find the next Arctic Monkeys, but it shines a spotlight on a scene that may otherwise have been ignored. And I think there's more focus on cities other than the likes of London and New York, which was helpful. On the downside, it meant that the word alternative, as an alternative rock, was eventually drained of all meaning. It's just become a marketing buzzword. The same, this idea that angst has become a marketable commodity, which, you know, Kurt recognised himself. Then there's this idea of you can just cynically exploit the legacy of a band for commercial gain. Rape Me was actually a very prescient song title. It's the fans that have also been exploited to an extent. And finally, ultimately, I think Nevermind led to Britpop. Select magazine in 93 had that cover with Suede on, had the, you know, Yanks, yeah, Go Home. And that was a sort of beginnings of a sort of promoting a sort of nascent London scene as some kind of response. This sort of jingoism, you know, I was never a fan of Britpop, but it did spring from it, I think.
You're right. I mean, it was explicit, actually. It was explicit. I remember when Modern Life is Rubbish, the second Blur album, yeah, came out, you know, they really sort of trumpeted that, and Blur were kind of openly sort of critical of American things until their fourth album, and Song 2, where they sort of embraced it.
I'm not sure they were. I think Albarn was. I think Graham Coxon always had some taste.
Yes, I'm sure, yeah. But, I mean, at the same time, I mean, I welcomed Nirvana because as, you know, things like the clothes for me were good, and the whole look, because not that I was able at that stage to indulge in that, having already finding myself follically challenged at that point. But in terms of the sort of cheap sort of charity shop style clothing, the kind of, you mentioned the working class backgrounds. I mean, it sort of was a little bit of a kind of halt to the kind of dandyism of the 80s, you know, where you had to be sort of, you know, sort of, you know, really good looking or really kind of well dressed to sort of get on in life. You know, I did welcome that. So I think there has been some influence, and probably that Britpop influence that really was only very strong here. And in America, I'm sure probably there was a lot more longevity to the whole heavier rock thing. Most recently, actually, in Oxford, where we're recording this podcast, there's a nice band called Slate Hearts who are very influenced by Nirvana, which I think we've all seen and really enjoyed them. So I think there have been bands over the years, admittedly owing a huge debt, but still nonetheless pretty good. So, yeah.
I would say on Ben's point that they cast a long and dark shadow. I don't think there are many things to celebrate, but there are quite a lot of things to lament. And I think at the end of Our Band Could Be Your Life, there's an elegiac quality to it, because basically what Nevermind did was flip the underground into the overground, and into the mainstream, and absolutely killed it.
Yeah.
And that is quite sad. I don't know if many of those bands
survived. I
agree,
but I don't think it's... You're laying the blame at their door, though, and saying that they are responsible for it. And, you know, obviously they're not knowingly responsible for it. But I think if you're looking from...
I just think they were the engine, yeah. They were the A&R engine for this kind of absolute demolition of any viable underground scene in American music in particular. And if you're telling me seriously that their major legacy musically is Britpop, then I'm incredibly unhappy...
I'm not
legacy as in sort of reaction to it was obviously,
and that still it kind of enabled it that horrible shit to happen.
Yeah,
it did. I mean, and it being a British phenomenon was quite interesting, because the fact that British journalists are the ones who were initially celebrating the Seattle scene, it was them that then, or the British press then had the reaction against it first to then sort of raise this spectre of Britain.
I was just opportunistic and just trying to sell papers, which they failed to do, you know, ultimately, you know, over the long period. I mean, I personally, I would say I am a little bit more open to Britpop, shall we say, and next month we do have Mike Gibbons on, and we will be talking about Manchester as a music city, which obviously has huge resonance in the
Can we just talk Britpop about Joy Division all the time, please?
Well, we shall see. I think we need to talk about the good and the bad.
I would say that Damon Albarn said something famously about Kurt, which was, why is he so miserable? I'm paraphrasing now. I hate that man with the heat of a thousand suns for that, because it's a complete failure of empathy from someone who would consider himself to be a pretty smart fellow.
Did he also not say that he would be happier, Kurt Cobain would be happier if he played football? I think he also said that.
I don't even know what to say to
that. He's an absolute cretin. Anyway, right, that's fine.
Yes, okay. All right, and just one last word. Don't want to get into it in danger of having an extra 20 minutes. but the circumstances surrounding Kurt's death, David, a few thoughts?
Well, look, I don't like your disparaging tone, Ben.
I've just put my hat on.
It makes me think that they got to you too, right? So hear me out. But like, I never really indulged in any of this stuff, right? I was such a huge Nirvana fan that really I was only interested in their body of work. And actually rereading Come As You Are, the most intriguing and exciting thing about that book was all these tantalising mentions of these other songs I'd never heard. I don't know about you guys, but those kind of CD fairs we used to flick through basically bootlegs, looking for one song you'd not heard, even if it was a live version of a song you'd never heard.
Yeah.
Like, God knows, like... David Geffen has a wing of his house that I paid for. I've got everything that Nirvana have ever done, bootleg or otherwise, right? But I basically was quite happy to just engage with the band as they were up until his sad demise. So I never went down the rabbit hole of any conspiracy theories about Kurt and Courtney. I never watched the Broomfield documentary. Mm. I never really engaged or indulged in any of the bullshit written about it. Because I felt that there was a really nasty sort of misogynistic element of the kind of pillorying of Courtney. And Ben lent me Dark Stuff, the Nick Love book, which has a chapter on Kurt Cobain.
And Nick Kent, yeah.
Nick Kent, sorry. It's one of the worst in there. I mean, the guy himself, when he's good, is great. But when he's bad, he's awful. Mm. And of course, he'd never met Kurt. He'd just basically been dragged off the street, from what I could make out, so slapped around and told to write 600 words. He talked about her being the merry widow of grunge. Hated it. But there are some circumstances about Kurt's death which are a bit fishy. Now, at best, I suppose, it's just complete incompetence from the Seattle PD. And the cop who headed up the investigation has since kind of been dismantled. His professional career has been dismantled. He's out of the force now. And many of the cases he ruled as murders sorry, as suicides turn out to be murders. Well, that's one thing. There are about 100 things. One thing I wasn't aware of is that there is a postscript in basically another person's handwriting which resembles Kurt's handwriting in another colour pen, in another font size, that's a good publishing term, at the end of Kurt's suicide note, where he says, "Courtney, you're brilliant, I love you so much, hang in there." And it's the only time he ever mentioned suicide, and it's been alleged quite persuasively that Courtney added it. And if you read the suicide note without knowing that he ended up blowing his face off, it looks like he's quitting music. It never mentions any kind of self-murder. He also signs it Kurt Cobain. Now, why would you sign your full name? There are also some other things about it, such as the room in which he was found was locked from the outside. Now, I've looked into this, Ben, and there is no evidence, as far as I can see, that Kurt Cobain was a magician. So draw your own conclusion on that. It was also like, oh God, I was at a wedding a couple of weekends ago. I end up speaking to an anaesthetist about the whole kind of the whole sequence of events by which he actually killed himself, because what he did was he injected himself somewhere between 3 and 5 times the kind of lethal dose of heroin, then shot himself. Now, there are many things about that which are unusual, not least of which that kind of death is entirely unique in American legal history. No one has ever jacked themselves up and then shot themselves. Never, not once in all American legal history, which is quite interesting, right? Because you look for outliers. You'd think you'd be feeling pretty fucking good about yourself if you took a massive dose of heroin. And you're probably not the most sort of dexterous at that point, where you're going to, because he put the caps back on his syringes, put them back into his little cigar box, opened up his wallet so his driving licence was there, then kind of sat down and thought, no, I still want to go through with it, and shot himself. There's a number of things there which don't add up.
Well, rumours that Damon Albarn was in the vicinity.
He was out front doing keepy-ups.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, all right. Well, that's our discussion about Nirvana, which I think you'll agree has been entertaining. And certainly for me, as someone who did come late to the band and haven't necessarily followed it, I've learned a lot tonight. I've heard some fantastic bits and pieces and some really, really persuasive, passionate arguments from both of you.
So you think Courtney did it? Yeah. You heard it here first.
We haven't even mentioned Pearl Jam. So on to the next section of the podcast. Fairly quick run through our album of the month. We do an album of the month every month. And this is Angel Olsen's second release, I think.
It's actually her third full length. It's called My Woman. She's an American singer-songwriter, which sounds bad, but bear with us. It's the third full-length solo album, studio album rather. She had a mini album before that. So the first one was called Halfway Home. It's quite folky. And then two or three years ago, Burn Your Fire for No Witness. The latter and the new album have both been released by Jag Jaguar, who I've banged on about several times on this podcast already. So I first came across her via a single called High Five from that last album. It's pretty extraordinary. It's about finding companionship and comfort in loneliness, and it somehow manages to blend sort of Roy Orbison with indie rock. It's quite amazing. The album as a whole is exceptional. This is Burn Your Fire for No Witness I'm talking about here. It's really stylistically varied. She was for the first time playing recording with a full band, so it kind of steps away from the folk beginnings. There's sort of an Americana influence as well. I'm kind of duty-bound. I think everyone is duty-bound to mention that she had a stint in Will Oldham, a.k.a. Bonnie Prince Billy's band. but I think that's probably only to emphasise the fact that she's completely transcended that past and, for me, eclipsed anything Will Oldham's ever done himself, personally. Mm-hmm. So, just to Rob first, what are your overall impressions of the album?
I think it's pleasant. It doesn't sound too... I don't want to be too...
that's a nice
down on it, but I... I'm not quite sure what all the fuss is about. I think that would be my take on it. I think it's well put together. It's got some good songs, some good lyrics. Some of the guitar work's excellent. I think the track Sister, is it?
Yeah,
is one where the guitar work is particularly kind of intricate and interesting. Some good kind of echoey sound on it as well here and there. Interesting you mentioned the Roy Orbison thing, which I hadn't picked up on, and I do think that's a very apt kind of mention, actually. I think I was trying to pin it, but it's certainly above the flock. It's not kind of, you know, bog standard average, but I'm not that excited by it. I need to possibly go back, and I haven't heard the other material particularly, so I need to go back and compare it to what's gone before. Yeah.
David?
Well, I consulted with Amy, formerly of this parish, talking about Pet Sounds.
Yeah.
Because I think she had, well, I know she has a great perspective on this stuff, because I just wanted to kind of triangulate my thoughts. In fact, you and I discussed this while we were playing with your son. We were playing Bad Shopkeeper unsuccessfully with his son down the play park. I think you're a bigger fan of this album than I am.
Yes, I think that's fair to say.
In a nutshell, I was really excited by the new single. It looked like that Shop Kiss Me is a great song, best song on the album by a million miles. And I was excited because she seemed to be taking an interesting direction. It reminded me, is it Courtney Barrett or
Courtney Barnett? It is very like that.
I was like, hang on a minute there. Talking about Nirvana's legacy, I think that album by Courtney Barnett does sound very Nirvana-ish in places. I think it was Amy who said to me that at Courtney Barnett's saddest is still not as sad as happy as Angel Olsen goes. I think it is I think we're going to get to it, Ben, but it's an album of two halves. I like Side A very much. And actually, Side A is appropriate in this context because I accidentally bought the cassette of this album. So I've actually bought two, because I bought Neil's band's EP last night. So I bought two tapes in 2 days.
But you hate hipsters, so...
I mean, please, do not call me a hipster. I've done this entirely by accident, unknowingly. And actually, funnily enough, I was saying to Ben on the way over that the last tape I bought was In Utero.
Really?
Yeah, before the 2 days ago, that was the last tape I bought.
Yeah.
So in terms of sort of standout tracks for me, Shut Up Kiss Me is fantastic. That's the second single. It's got a sort of 90s indie rock feel, I think, quite similar to a song called Forgiven Forgotten on the previous album. It's got a sort of, it's all lust fueled, that single, I think, but it's got a desperate edge to it as well, which is quite interesting. The first single was a song called Intern, which is the very first song on the album, which is quite strikingly different, I think, to anything she'd done before and anything on the album. Quite synthy and percussion free. The first song that makes the sort of the second side, I think, Heart Shaped Face is really good. I also really like the song Not Gonna Kill You, which seems like she's almost in conversation with herself, because the final song on Burn Your Fire for No Witness, called Windows, has got this great line at the end, the climax, what's wrong with the light? And in this song, she's saying, I let the light in. And the chorus is, it's not going to break you, it's going to shake you alive. So it's actually saying, you really should be letting the light in. It's kind of almost a conversation across albums, which I think is quite interesting. We talked about, you mentioned, David, this idea of it being an album of two halves. She's actually said it was deliberately structured in this way. I think that's probably obvious. She said the first half was for an upbeat day, if you're feeling that mood, and second half to be more reflective. Now, do you think it works? I mean, you're saying that you preferred the material in the first half. Is it just stronger the first half, do you think?
Yeah, I do. It seems like you maybe...
Yeah, better songs, I think. Yeah, I think so. I mean, I haven't... I'm a bit of a Luddite. I'm using CD, so where to define what's the first half and what's the second?
Ten songs, so I just stayed in the middle.
Yeah. I think, end you my tape.
Yeah. I think... the first half is certainly the more immediate, upbeat half, so I think it's the half that's going to stick. But for me, the second half is definitely more subtle, but I think it's the first half that gets you initially hooked, but then the second half is what actually kept me coming back. Those songs, they're quite long, some of them, but they keep revealing like new depths. I think the first, Shut Up Kiss Me, for instance, is an instant hit. So the first time I heard that, I thought, this is going to be one of the best singles of the year, and I sort of think it is. But it doesn't give up more, I don't think, over repeated listens, I wouldn't say.
You make me feel and sound like I'm some sort of idiot where I'm not able to kind of reveal the hidden depths of that B-side.
I didn't want to imply that.
No, but Ben, you've done it very successfully, and congratulations. I don't think I've worked as hard as I possibly could have done this album. And it's not like I can't listen to depressing music, but... or slow music or whatever. Like, I don't have to... You know, not all of the albums I love are just basically a kind of Owl Haribo or whatever. But I don't know.
But in fairness, if there's albums you sometimes want to work at, and if you're not getting something from an album after a little while, then you might want to give up. That's perfectly fair enough. I think there's a lot going on in there. But I guess the songs, possibly after a while, they might seem a little bit samey if you've given only a few listens, I'd say. Whereas the first half is both upbeat and also quite immediate, but also quite stylistically varied as well, I think.
Which either means that she's still an artist searching for a sound.
Well, I was going to kind of come on to that, actually. Okay. But yeah, I mean, this album to me seems to be all about identity. Now, what did you think of it musically in terms of identity?
I mean, it's quite Magpie-ish, certainly the first half. And again, Amy talks about there being almost like a 60s girl group vibe to this.
Yeah.
And she was the one who turned me onto that Pitchfork article, which I think all of us read, is that right? Where she's pretty hostile to the idea of being labelled pop. Amy's perspective on that has got something to do with this idea that female artists aren't being taken that seriously. She's a singer-songwriter, right? And maybe being labelled in that way is hostile to her view of herself as an artist.
I don't know. I mean, Amy, unless I'm misrepresenting her, is a massive advocate of pop as a kind of serious kind of, you know...
Yeah, she is. But what she's saying is that Angel Olsen is very hostile to that categorisation because she thinks it diminishes her status as a singer-songwriter.
It's a bit of a sort of rockist attitude, I think, isn't it? It's diminishing and trivialising. You're saying that pop basically is trivial. But I mean, in her defence, I would say that article basically shows that she doesn't want to be pigeonholed in any way, because she's also talking about not wanting to be pigeonholed as some sort of sad sack country singer, which is she has been pigeonholed by most people, I think.
I wish the album was a bit more pop, quite frankly. Yeah, sure. I have a bit of a low tolerance threshold for folk and Americana.
Well,
and it really does seem to me an album influenced very heavily by both those genres, and it could do with a bit more of the Phil Spector style wall of sound
I'd say the previous album is possibly not quite as musically varied, but it is also still musically varied, but the folk and the Americana are probably stronger though. This has probably got a slightly more pop feel to it.
Yeah.
Maybe she's going in that way, but the fact she's rejecting the label pop, I think she's just generally rejecting labels, I think.
Fair enough.
I think it's sort of a conscious strategy. Now, that could seem like a very incoherent album and someone who doesn't really know what they're doing and where they want to be going, but actually I do think it really works, but that's my personal opinion compared to you guys. What do you think it says about, if anything, about sort of personal identity? I was interested to know. I mean, she's actually in that article, I think it's revealed that she's actually adopted, and I wonder whether it comes across as being like a search for identity, personal identity.
Well, I mean, that's reasonably highfalutin. I would have to go back to the lyrics to really have a good look for that. Like, Amy and I were discussing whether or not it was actually a concept album in some way, but because there seems to be some sort of optimism and a relationship that seems to break down halfway through the album, leading to the more melancholy B-side.
Yeah, I think she almost seems to be talking about relationship in the first half, but in the second half it seems to be more focused on herself, I think.
Like David, I mean, just to completely detonate my credibility as a podcast host, I don't think I've listened to it in enough detail, the lyrics. I mean, I've listened to it in the car several times, and it's just been the songs I've not really kind of examined. Yeah.
So what are you getting at, Ben? What have you heard?
Well, one of the very first lines of Intern is, doesn't matter who you are or what you've done, still got to wake up and be someone. So it's about this pressure to put on a public face, I guess. And part of it, with these different voices, she's playing different characters almost, it seems, in different songs. Is she avoiding revealing her own personal identity, or is she actually saying that identity is a fluid thing and it's multifaceted? I think that's what she's getting at.
Holy heck, kids.
And at the end, well, the fact that the penultimate song, Woman, you know, there's the line, I dare you to try to understand what makes me a woman, and that's effectively what the album is saying, I think.
I just think you're ascribing it to some pretty lofty... I
mean, that's kind of what she's talking about.
The lyric you just quoted sounds like something off of What's a Story, Morning Glory.
Just to bring the conversation full circle, yeah. Yes.
Well, fair enough. But I think that's what she's getting at, I think, in the article.
Okay.
But I think it's a very strong theme. I think it works really well.
Certainly a very, you know, it's a really interesting release. I mean, I think, and, you know, sort of significant album that's, you know, going to be, I'm sure, very prominent in end of year polls and critics lists, which we'll try and tackle in some respect later on in the podcast. Okay, well, that's a really, really interesting discussion. Really enjoyed the topics this month. Just a quick word, we'll be back in probably a little over a month's time, depending on when you listen to it, of course, with a review of Manchester as a Music City, as I mentioned, with Mike Gibbons, who's just published a book which is extremely good about Euro 96 football tournament that happened in the middle of the Britpop era. Just a couple of extra words on the coordinates. We are, of course, at soundingboard.podbean.com. That's a good place to kind of just play the podcast on your phone or your computer, or to download it. We're also on iTunes. And, of course, if you want to leave a review on iTunes, as a couple of kind souls have done, that would be very, very grateful, because apparently that pushes us up some sort of theoretical charts. We're also on email at soundingboard@gmx.com, and we also have a Facebook presence. So thanks very much in particular to David, and this certainly won't be the last time that we have David on the podcast, because there's a lot of other interesting topics we can bring to the table. And
moon landings JFK.
Yeah, we might branch out a bit, but thanks very much for listening, and we'll be back in about a month. Thank you.